These voices made headlines this week.
Ours is a sophisticated form of discrimination. Yours is a hard-nosed form.
We're not hypocritical about it. We've said to the world we believe and practice segregation.
We are still hopeful that the participating countries may reach an agreement to end nuclear testing.
The ABC Radio Network presents Voices in the Headlines, an audio review of the news this week gathered from around the world by the staff of ABC Radio News.
This is Fred Foy with Voices in the Headlines. The third week of July, 1963, the week in which man saw the face of the sun blotted from view, a solar eclipse. A scientific phenomenon that thrilled curious millions all across the globe. The same phenomenon that in past centuries caused millions to panic, nations to fall, and in one case, caused an armistice. For those who still believe in heavenly omens, attention this week was focused on the city of Moscow, where delegates from the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union met to discuss the fate of man. The issue was a first step toward world disarmament, a mutual agreement that would halt the testing of nuclear weapons. At midweek, President Kennedy expressed guarded optimism.
We are still hopeful that the participating countries may reach an agreement to end nuclear testing, at least in the environments in which it is agreed that on-the-ground inspection is not required for reasonable security. The negotiations so far are going forward in a businesslike way.
When the current talks started in Moscow, the atmosphere was anything but businesslike. Premier Khrushchev seemed to go out of his way to create a jovial atmosphere. Let's sign an agreement now, he joked, and fill in the facts later. As one observer put it, he acted as if he really wanted a treaty. As the week went on and the negotiations progressed, it became apparent that the Soviet premier did. On Friday, Khrushchev went out of his way to create the impression that a major turn in East-West relations was about to occur. In a major Kremlin speech, he all but promised the West the keys to the Kremlin. He called for a non-aggression pact between NATO and the Warsaw Pact nations. He called for a reduction of force in East and West Germany and a freeze of military budgets. He called for an exchange of inspectors to provide assurances against surprise attack. Western observers were hard put to hide their surprise. More was being accomplished in 1 week than had been in 18 years. Finally, this word came from ABC's Moscow correspondent, Sam Jaffe.
An East-West test ban agreement will be announced early next week. This disclosure was made to me by an authoritative Western source. The tripartite negotiators are nearing the last stages of hammering out the treaty. Though the question of a non-aggression pact between NATO and the Warsaw Treaty countries has been discussed with little objection to it from the Western negotiators, it will not be a condition to an agreement on the test ban issue.
On Saturday, Jaffe's prediction was confirmed and tentative agreement was reached on the draft of a test ban treaty. But still, many Western diplomats are unconvinced, just a little bit suspicious, a little bit leery. At doubt was Khrushchev's sincerity. Sam Jaffe was asked his opinion.
I think he is sincere in wanting this test ban. I think the Sino-Soviet dispute plays a major role in this, but I think that other internal problems force the Soviet Union now to try to get along with the West.
Those internal problems Jaffe referred to concern two things mainly. One was the split in relations between China and the Soviet Union. The other was an ever-growing awareness that the Soviet economy needed the money now being diverted to nuclear testing. But still, suspicion of the Russian motives continued to exist. The greatest expressions of doubt came from the Senate, which would have to ratify any test ban treaty before it could take effect. Senator Strom Thurmond expressed it this way.
Unfortunately, our policy planners are evidently walking into this nuclear test ban trap with their eyes closed and their hopes high.
From the White House, no comment. If international tensions seem to be easing this week, tensions at home seem to be doing anything but. The nation's racial crisis continue to hold the national interest, from New York to Washington to Georgia and as far west as Hollywood. In Washington, the administration's battle for passage of its civil rights program continued. Attorney General Robert Kennedy went before the Senate Judiciary Committee. As he's done for the past several weeks, he asked for support of the most controversial aspect of the civil rights program, the Public Accommodations Act. At the same time, he spoke out against the use of violence as a means of gaining civil rights.
We cannot excuse violence from any source or from any group. The responsibility of the Negro leaders who set these demonstrations in motion is very great, as is the responsibility of the white leadership of every community. But our responsibility as a nation is most plain. We must remove the injustices.
As the Attorney General testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Senate Commerce Committee continued to hold hearings on the bill. Star witness this week, Governor George Wallace of Alabama.
The president who sponsors legislation such as the Civil Rights Act of 1963 should be retired from public life. And this goes for any governor, other public official who has joined in a mad scramble for the minority block vote. Does not the present situation in Washington, D.C. give you some idea of the results you would obtain with this legislation? The nation capital is supposed to be the supreme example of what civil rights legislation can accomplish. It's an example, all right, an example of a city practically deserted by white people. If you in the Congress are really sincere about this civil rights business, why don't you give home rule to the people of Washington? Let's see how the local residents can run this city. I believe in local self-government. I challenge you to vote for home rule in Washington, D.C. I suspect if you attempted to do this, the Secretary of State would have to testify behind closed doors that this would result in damage to our image before the rest of the world.
Governor Wallace went on to say,
if you intend to pass this bill, you should make preparations to withdraw all our troops from Berlin, Vietnam, and the rest of the world because they're going to be needed to police this country. You're going to make the American people law violators because they are not going to comply with this type of legislation.
Taking issue with the governor was a member of the Commerce Committee, Senator Philip Hart of Michigan. Senator Hart commented on charges that there was just as much discrimination in the North as there was in the South.
Ours is a sophisticated form of discrimination. Yours is a hard-nosed form. And I'm not at all sure which form is the more offensive to the Negro.
A reply to the senator's remarks came from Governor Wallace.
But at least we are open and above board about it. A Negro knows where he can go, and a white knows where he can go. But he don't know where he can go in Michigan because he may be embarrassed. We're not hypocritical about it. We've said to the world we believe and practice segregation.
All in all, Governor Wallace received a somewhat cool reception from the senators. He tried to present what he called proof designed to show that Negro leader Martin Luther King was associated with communists. The highlight of Governor Wallace's appearance, though, was when he started to say, "Some of my best friends are Negroes." He was drowned out by laughter. Efforts by Governor Wallace to associate Martin Luther King and other Negro leaders with communists proved somewhat fruitless. Senator Mike Monroney of Oklahoma called the charge reminiscent of McCarthyism. President Kennedy also had a comment or two.
We have no evidence that any of the leaders of the civil rights movements in the United States are communists. We have no evidence that the demonstrations are communist-inspired. It may be occasions when a communist takes part in a demonstration. We can't prevent that, but I think it's a convenient scapegoat to suggest that all the difficulties are communist, and if the communist movement would only disappear, that we would end this.
This week, no end appeared in sight. Demonstrations occurred in cities and towns across the nation, in New York and Philadelphia, in Chicago, in Savannah, in Cambridge. In some cases, violence occurred or was on the brink of occurring. Comment on the matter came from Negro leader Roy Wilkins.
Nobody can pledge to keep anybody from violence. We're dealing with 18 million Negroes. How is anybody going to pledge to keep them from violence?
Additional comment came from the president during his news conference. Specifically, he was referring to Cambridge, Maryland.
You've got an increasingly dangerous situation. You could have violence any night. You've got 400 National Guardsmen there. Now, I'm concerned about those demonstrations. I think they go beyond information, they go beyond protest, and they get into a very bad situation where you get violence, and I think the cause of advancing equal opportunities only loses.
Some of the most spectacular violence this week occurred in Charleston, South Carolina. On Tuesday, some 500 Negroes congregated in front of the Charleston News and Courier building. Everything was peaceful until police started making arrests on trespass charges. Then someone threw a brick. Telling the story, city editor Douglas Donahue.
They seemed to work themselves into a frenzy, and all of a sudden, police lieutenant Tillman, Lieutenant Tally Tillman, was struck in the face by a brick, and he fell down to the street. He was right in the middle of the street. He fell down, and blood was gushing out the side of his mouth and onto his white shirt.
What happened next? Mr. Donahue continued.
There was really a change in the mood of the mob then, because they started converging upon the spot where Tillman was ringed by his fellow policemen. And these policemen were, they were just at the mercy of this crowd, and there were some of them screaming, "Kill him, kill him, kill him."
Fortunately, no one was killed, but six policemen and a fireman were injured. Over 100 Negroes were arrested that night, and the next day, state troopers were ordered into the city, and the National Guard was alerted. At week's end, the situation remained tense. For the most part, racial violence this week was held to a minimum, and participation in anti-segregation demonstrations seemed to be falling off. But Negro leaders made it clear that this was only temporary. The demonstrations, they said, would not only continue, they would continue in force. To make certain of that fact, seven major Negro groups met in New York this week to unify their efforts. Integration leaders made it clear that they would carry out their threat to march on Washington and would continue other mass demonstrations in various locations throughout the nation. They also made it clear that every effort would be made to keep the demonstrations peaceful. The next target, said the Negroes, would be Hollywood. Integration leader Herbert Hill put it this way.
We simply want Hollywood to tell the truth about the Negro. Our demand on this point is not radical. We simply want Hollywood to tell the truth about 20 million citizens of color in the United States.
To back up this and other demands, demonstrations will be launched at movie and television studios in Hollywood and at theaters in 40 cities across the United States. Taking note of the deepening racial crisis this week, the Pentagon. Defense Department officials issued orders that virtually prohibit members of the armed forces from taking part in racial demonstrations. Servicemen could take part, said the Pentagon, but not under these conditions.
1. During hours when they are required to be present for duty. 2. When they are in uniform. 3. When they are on a military reservation. 4. When their activities constitute a breach of law and order. Or 5. When violence is reasonably likely to result.
That, as someone observed, covered just about everything. The United States wasn't the only country in the world having racial problems. Tiny Vietnam was having its share, too. During the past several weeks, thousands of Buddhists have been demonstrating against alleged racial discrimination on the part of President Diem, a Roman Catholic. Violence has broken out in the streets. Hundreds have been killed and injured. Commenting on the situation this week, President Kennedy.
I think it's unfortunate that this dispute has arisen at a very time when the military struggle has been going better than it's been going in many months. I would hope that some solution could be reached for this dispute, which is certainly began as a religious dispute, and because we've invested a tremendous amount of effort, and it's going quite well.
At least it seemed to be going quite well, sometimes. Earlier in the week, 17 American military advisors were injured in a communist attack on an airfield north of Saigon. It was the largest single number of American casualties ever to occur in Vietnam. Late Saturday came a more encouraging report. Some 58 communist guerrillas were killed in a new Vietnamese offensive. For 2 years, the Securities and Exchange Commission has been holding an investigation of the stock market. This week, in a second report on that investigation, a special SEC committee called for sweeping changes, changes that would affect Wall Street operations and market practices. Commenting on the report, Edwin Etherington, president of the American Stock Exchange.
I'm told the chapters issued by the SEC yesterday weighed 12 pounds and 5 ounces. I haven't weighed them, but as I look at them, they appear to be about a foot long. I don't think probably the fastest readers have had a chance really to digest the whole thing. In any case, we haven't had a good opportunity to study the chapters in detail. Until we do, we really can't comment. I can say, though, that we will welcome any constructive proposals, and we will also look forward to the opportunity to express any reservations we may have on comments or proposals that seem ill-advised.
To many people on Wall Street, the whole report seemed ill-advised. Most market experts and quite a few amateur traders felt that if the recommendations were put into effect, it would have an unsettling effect on private enterprise, perhaps even on the economy. Indicating this feeling, a downward trend in the stock market. There were other news items that didn't help the market very much. News that President Kennedy asked for a higher tax rate on foreign securities traded in the United States. And news of an impending rail strike. Throughout the week, 11th-hour efforts to bring about a settlement in the rail dispute continued in earnest. On Tuesday, Senator Mike Mansfield made this statement.
We're very hopeful that there will be a settlement in the discussions now going on by the Special Presidential Board by next Monday, because if there is not, of course, then the President will have to make a move.
The move the President would have to make is a very simple one. He'd have to ask Congress for some kind of a law that would prevent the unions of the Rail Brotherhood from striking against the carriers. Though Senator Mansfield said he was hopeful this would have to be done, there were others who didn't agree. One was J. Handley Wright of the American Association of Railroads.
The refusal of the railroad operating unions to consider any reasonable proposal for settlement of the work rules dispute leaves legislation as the only remaining means we can see of heading off a calamitous nationwide rail strike.
Even so, efforts continue to bring about a solution through collective bargaining. Throughout the weekend, Labor Secretary Wirtz met with leaders of both sides, but apparently to no avail. History of a sort was made this week, and the United States became just a little bit smaller because of it. It all started about 100 years ago when the Rio Grande suddenly changed its course, altering the natural boundary between the United States and Mexico. In the middle, a little piece of land known as El Chamizal, 336 acres of overgrown thicket that few people ever gave any thought to, until the Rio Grande changed its course. All of a sudden, what was once a part of Mexico became a part of Texas. At least that's what Texas said. Mexico felt differently. Finally, after 100 years, the matter was settled. Those 336 acres go back to Mexico. But there's one little problem. It seems that El Chamizal is now part of El Paso, a very important, highly developed part. Some 700 families now live there. How does El Paso feel about losing part of itself? Mayor Judson Williams put it this way.
It's something that we've been expecting to occur, and I suppose that under the circumstances, we're glad it's coming to a head. As far as El Paso's concerned, this is a matter of international relations and not one of community relations. And if this is in the interest of better international relations, we certainly have no objection to it.
How do the 700 American families feel? What do they think about the decision?
Well, I think in the main, if their interests are protected, and by that I mean they are going to be properly given relocation value, they're not going to object too strongly.
There were some people, though, who were a little saddened by it all. As one old-timer put it, in the old days, we would have started a good ruckus over that land. Now we just give it away. For the president, Thursday was one of those days when he would have been better off staying indoors. Waiting on the White House lawn for him were some 2,500 singing, screaming foreign students, all of whom wanted to shake the president's hand, get his autograph, see him smile. They quieted down long enough to hear him say a few words as well.
I hope when you go back to your country and you read all the terrible things that they write and say about the United States, that you will occasionally remember that they are talking about a family in Davenport, Iowa, or in Massachusetts, or in California. How many here come from California? I hope that you will write to some of the families when you've gone home, and that they will write to you, and that someday you will come back to the United States when I'm old and gray as a president or as a president, or even more importantly, as a first lady of your country. Thank you.
When it was all over, the president was missing a pocket handkerchief and a P.T. boat tie clasp. A Secret Service man was missing a shoe, and another lost half his tie. At week's end, the young boy who took Mr. Kennedy's tie clasp had misgivings. He returned it with a note of apology. The Secret Service man's tie? Half of it is still missing. Thus, the third week of July, 1963. An eventful week, a troublesome week, a week much the same as any other. To the superstitious, that solar eclipse had much to do with the troublesome part of it. It's been that way since man's first record of time. Ancient documents, for instance, record that in 2137 BC, two Chinese astronomers named Hai and Ho were beheaded because they got drunk. They failed to carry out their job of beating drums and shooting arrows to discourage the dragon that was devouring the sun. Modern astronomers aren't exempt from troubles caused by an eclipse. This was proved on Saturday when an angry woman from Troy, New York, complained about warnings that viewing the eclipse could cause serious eye damage. Complained she to an astronomer, "Why are you having an eclipse if you can't watch it?" So went this world this week, and the voices in the headlines.
Voices in the Headlines, a presentation of ABC Radio News. Written and produced by Edward Hanna. Directed by Art Klein. Executive producer, Tom O'Brien. Audio engineering, Henry Zeitlinger, Jack McCarthy, and Pete Sarantopoulos. Special effects, Walter Gustafson. Your narrator was Fred Ford.
Don McNeil's Breakfast Club, weekday on the ABC Radio Network.